Welcome to The Word at First Pres. Our fall sermon series is called Come to Jesus Moments. Throughout this series, we will be having hard conversations about important issues that impact all of our lives. Thanks for listening.
And our first scripture reading today comes from 2 Chronicles, the first chapter, verses 7 through 12. That night, God appeared to Solomon and said to him, "Ask what I should give you." And Solomon said to God, "You have shown great and steadfast love to my father David, and have made me succeed him as king, O Lord God. Let your promise to my father David now be fulfilled, for you have made me king over a people as numerous as the dust of the earth. Give me now wisdom and knowledge to go out and come in before this people, for who can rule this great people of yours?" God answered Solomon, "Because this was in your heart, and you have not asked for possessions, wealth, honor, or the life of those who hate you, and have not even asked for long life, but have asked for wisdom and knowledge for yourself, that you may rule my people over whom I have made you king, wisdom and knowledge are granted to you. I will give you riches, possessions, and honor, such as none of the kings had who were before you, and none after you shall have the like." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
So our scripture reading today is Matthew 18, 1 to 5. Jesus says, or at that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a child whom he put among them and said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So we started a sermon series last week called Come to Jesus Moments. And the idea behind this sermon series is that we are talking about a come-to-Jesus moment. What is a come-to-Jesus moment or a come-to-Jesus talk? It's where we have a hard conversation about an important topic. And that's what we're going to be doing throughout this series. We're going to be having hard conversations, sometimes about issues that affect you personally, sometimes about issues that affect Christianity and the church, sometimes about issues that affect society and culture, sometimes all three of those at once. Usually we don't talk about these things because we don't want to offend anyone. That's a big thing, like we don't want to make anybody upset. But if we don't talk about these issues, then I really think we're doing ourselves a disservice because we can't do anything about them. And we need to be able to make changes in our lives. So when we talk about this topic, my hope is that you will make small little changes in your life that will hopefully impact the world in a larger way. Cool? Cool. All right. So last week we talked about a thing called the technology paradox. If you weren't here, I would say go back and watch that. That was what I called my softball sermon. It was kind of like an easy way to get into this. Each week we're going to turn up the heat a little bit on this one. Today we're going to turn up the heat a little bit more. And we're going to be doing an offshoot of the technology paradox, which has to do with managing information. So today, in our world, you have access to information very easily. Would you agree? Of course, right? You can get on the internet, you can type in, you can find anything you want. Now compare that to 100 years ago. I mean, we have more access to information today than we have ever had in the history of humanity. The problem is, though, what do you privilege as being fact versus fiction? Because there's so much information out there. How do you determine what's true and false? And I think this is a really hard thing for us to be able to do, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And to do this, I'd like to begin by telling you a story. And this story begins with a man named Barney Graham. So Barney Graham, he was born in 1953 in the great state of Kansas. He had a dentist for a father, and his mother was a teacher. And he grew up on a hog farm, and that's where he was introduced to veterinary medicine. He and his brother both got into that. He happened to be a very good student. He graduated valedictorian of his high school class. And as a result, he ended up getting into Rice University, my alma mater. Got it on your bingo card? We can put it down. So he got in and he studied biology. and from there he went on to medical school at Kansas University. He graduated from Kansas University Medical School in 1979, and it was there that he met his wife. Now, his wife Cynthia, they hadn't gotten married in 1979. They were about ready to move on and go to their residencies. And of course, she wanted to be in the same geographic location. But there was a little problem with this because Graham, as you can see right there, is white. His wife was black. And so she recommended that they go to Nashville, because in Nashville he could go to Vanderbilt and she could go to Meharry Medical College, which was a historically black college. Now, keep in mind, this is 1979. Tennessee had just repealed their ban on interracial marriage. So it just so happens that one day he's driving across country and it's Christmas Eve. And he decides, because he's in Nashville, he just is in Nashville at that point, he's going to go to Vanderbilt. And he walks into the medical school, and he goes up to see if anybody's there. He figures nobody's going to be there. But the director of the residency program is in his office, and he says, "Hey, can I speak to you?" And so he walks in, and he says, "Look, I know this is the South, and I want you to know that I'm going to be marrying a black woman, and if that is a problem, I can't come here." And the director says, "Shut the door." So he goes and he shuts the door. And he says, "I want you to know that you have a spot here." And he welcomed him right there on the spot. He's like, "You're in. Don't worry about it." And he was a rising star. They came there. She got into Meharry. They went to school together. By 1982, he was the chief resident at Nashville General Hospital. So within 3 years, he was the chief resident. That means, that shows you how good he was. That same year he became the chief resident, a patient came in to Nashville General who had 5 simultaneous infections. Cryptococcal meningitis and herpes simplex among them. And he realized that he was dealing with his first AIDS patient. In fact, the first AIDS patient in Tennessee. And so he worked with this guy and he was able to keep him alive for 3 weeks. And from that point forward, he told everybody in the state, "If you come across anybody with HIV AIDS, send them to me." And he was participating in all these clinical trials. He worked very hard. He was on the front lines of the AIDS epidemic of the 80s, and he became known all over the country for what he was willing to do for these people. So, because of his work, he ends up in the year 2000 being given an offer by the National Institute of Health. And they say, "Look, we want to do something completely new. We want to create what's called a vaccine evaluation clinic. And would you be willing to head this up?" And he said, "Absolutely, I would love to do it." And the idea was they were going to focus on 3 different viruses, creating vaccines for 3 viruses. Influenza, which you all know is the flu, right? And that's where we get the flu vaccine every year, still from this vaccine evaluation clinic. The second was RSV, which is a virus that causes pneumonia in little infant babies. And the third was coronaviruses. And so in the year 2000, he ends up working on RSV. They said, "We need you to make a vaccine for RSV. That's very, very important." So he starts working on it. And really for the first decade, he's trying to understand this virus and how it works. And he's really not getting anywhere because the technology wasn't very good. And in 2008, his fortunes turned. Because one day, he was leaving his office out of his building, and there was this guy, his name was Jason McClellan, who was working on a different floor. Jason McClellan was a postdoc in biophysics. He was working on HIV in a lab, and he lost his postdoc position because they lost funding. So they were walking out together. He goes, "Hey, Jason, how you doing?" And he's like, "Well, I just lost my postdoc position. I don't know what I'm going to do." And he says, "Why don't you come work with me? I would love to have you at my vaccine clinic." And so he comes over and he starts working with him. And the thing is that he had this vast knowledge of HIV. And he had just developed this process of being able to take a photo, literally a photo of HIV. They had developed this microscope that could do it, and they could get like right in on it. And so they use this same technology to be able to take a photo of RSV. This is what RSV looks like. And what they noticed when they saw it is that it was covered by this protein. And the protein looked like a spike on the outside of it. And as they studied it, they realized that when this spike protein was active, it basically made it so that your body couldn't find the virus. Didn't know it was even there. And so they realized that if they were going to make a vaccine for RSV, then they were going to have to neutralize that spike protein so that your body could see it and destroy it. So they began this process in 2008. And by 2013, they had finished human clinical trials, and it was amazing what they could do, right? They could give this vaccine to a pregnant mother, and the antibodies would be in the baby for the first 6 months after the baby was born, which was the period that was the most vital for a child who might contract RSV and it would kill them, because the thing is that children were dying all the time from RSV, and it was something that really we had no way to prevent. Now, this was hailed as one of the biggest medical breakthroughs in infectious disease in a decade. And it ushered in this new era of precision vaccinology. People were just, they thought it was just amazing. And they next turned their sights to MERS, this virus. You probably remember MERS. It was back in 2012. It emerged in Saudi Arabia, a very deadly virus. Killed 1 in 3 people who got it. The only reason it didn't become a global pandemic is because it burned itself out. Well, as you can see, it has what? A spike protein, right? So they were able to use the same methodology to create a vaccine for it. And they got as far as creating the vaccine and testing it in lab rats, but it didn't go any further than that because they lost funding. They were like, well, it's not an imminent threat anymore, so we're not going to go to human clinical trials, which Graham thought was an absolute travesty because he's like, this thing can come back, and we want to make sure that we're ready. He felt it was short-sighted, but they moved on. And the two of them ended up going their separate ways. Jason McClellan, he ended up getting a tenure-track position down at the University of Texas in Austin. And, of course, Graham continued his work with the vaccine clinic. Years go by, the technology improves, and they have this new electron microscope now where you can see any microbe down to 1/10 billionth of a meter. You can literally see the spike protein in ultra-high resolution. This is important because in December of 2019, there was, of course, this word that there was this virus spreading around Wuhan, China. And Graham heard about this, and he suspected that because of the pneumonia-like symptoms, it was likely a coronavirus. And so he wrote to the Chinese scientist who he knew over in China. He said, hey, when you get the genomic sequence for this virus, please send it to me. In the meantime, he calls up Jason McClellan. He's like, hey, I don't know if you've heard about this virus over in Wuhan, but I think it's a coronavirus. Would you be willing to work with me on creating a vaccine for it? And Jason was like, absolutely. Now, this is the most amazing part of this story. Friday night, January 10th, the Chinese scientists send over the genomic sequence of COVID-19. The next morning, January 11th, they get up together. They start working on the scheme to be able to neutralize the spike protein on COVID-19 so that our bodies can find it and defeat it. January 13th, they send the scheme to Moderna to begin producing the vaccine. 7 days before the first case of COVID-19 was landing on U.S. soil. 6 weeks later, after they had done that, Moderna was producing the vaccine, sending it out for clinical trials. Generally speaking, it takes years, if not decades, to create a vaccine. But in this instance, it was the fastest that they had ever created a vaccine in the history of medicine. And the reason why is because of the decades of research these two men had put in working on RSV and coronaviruses. Later, they had tested it on animals, and they said that it worked. And by March 16th, they were doing human clinical trials, and Moderna had upped their production to 1 million doses per month. Now, why have I told you this story? I tell you this story, first of all, because it's very unknown. Most people don't know about the story of how the coronavirus vaccine was produced for COVID-19. And it's an amazing story to know that how these guys came up with it. The second reason that I tell you this, though, is because during the pandemic, I can't tell you how many times I heard people say, how did these scientists produce this vaccine so quickly? And how do they know that it's safe? Well, the answer to both of those questions is that these two men dedicated their lives to studying these viruses. And it's not like they made it up out of nowhere. It's not like they were like, you know what, let's just try some things and we'll see what happens, right? They had put blood, sweat, and tears into studying these viruses, and so they knew exactly what was needed to neutralize them. And thank God for that, right? I mean, thank God for them. If it wasn't because of these two guys, millions more people would have died from this virus. Now, take these two men for a minute, right? We talked about Solomon a little while ago, right? Solomon was known as a man for his wisdom. And you think about these two guys. Think about the education they went through. So, if we're talking about Barney Graham, he spent 12 years in medical school, going through his residency, doing all the things he needed to do to learn what he learned. And then he got into the lab and he worked there. Jason McClellan, 10 years of time studying biophysics to be able to do what he did. I can count on one hand the number of people in this congregation who could have a conversation with these two men on a level where they understand what it is that they did and how they created this. I'm talking about two people, and I'm not one of them, I can tell you that for sure. And if you extrapolate that out to the whole population, you're talking about a real minority of people who understand the science behind this. And yet, if you sign on to Google and you type in coronavirus vaccine, you will find tens of thousands of people who will tell you that the coronavirus vaccine is ineffective, that it will kill you, that there are microchips inside of it. Now, you are welcome to read whatever you want, right? It is a free country. You're welcome to your opinion. You can see whatever you want. But I can tell you that when it comes to me personally, unless you happen to be Barney Graham, Jason McClellan, or one of their close colleagues, I don't really care what you have to say about it. And the reason why is because you and I, we don't understand the science behind this. It doesn't matter what we think. Our opinions on this don't matter because we are not people who are experts in this area. But yet today, you get on a Google search engine, everybody's an expert, right? And this is why people, when they get sick, they argue with their doctors, right? They go in and they've gone on WebMD and they've typed in their symptoms and they're going to say, well, I think I have this, right? As opposed to listening to a doctor who's gone through all this training, right? At least 12 years of training and has been in practice for that long. Now, this is not to say that doctors are perfect, right? Doctors make mistakes. Sometimes people have that kind of wisdom that we talk about, like they have a wisdom about their body, like Solomon. Solomon had this innate wisdom. Some people do have that. And I've seen it. Judy and I, all the time, right? We deal with people who are sick. In my last church, there was a woman who was having trouble swallowing. And she went to the doctor and she was like, I'm having trouble. They did the scope. They did all the stuff to try to see. They're like, there's nothing wrong with you. And she kept coming back saying, there is a problem. And they're like, maybe it's allergies, this, that. She went to doctor after doctor after doctor. Turns out, she had throat cancer. And it actually took her life. Now, I'm saying, doctors are humans. They can make mistakes. But here's the thing. That said, your education, when you have an education, particularly in a certain area, maybe it's medicine, maybe it's science, maybe it's engineering, maybe it's finance, whatever it is, that education gives you a deeper sense of the world in that area than other people who don't have that education. Would you agree? Okay, so the things that you've studied, whatever it is, if you're a teacher, right, if you're a nurse, these things, you know more about that area than people who haven't studied that. I'll give you an example right here, right? So, how many of you, for the most part, have gone to church most of your life? Not everybody here, but I know most of you have, right? How many of you have done Bible studies and read the Bible, right? Okay, now, that's a good thing, and I know that you've read it, right? But what most people don't realize is there is a big difference between doing a Bible study
and getting a degree in religious history, right? Getting your degree in religious studies, that's different. I spent 4 years studying that, right? Doing a degree in religious studies, and then I went 3 years in seminary. So did Judy, right? And so what happens is when we read a scripture, like what we've read this morning, when Judy and I read it, and you all read it, we're seeing two different things. Because of all the academic books and journals and the background that we have, we're seeing completely different things. Now, this is not to say that our opinion is always right. Well, Judy's opinion is always right. She'll let you know that. But my opinion is not always right when we're talking about the Bible. But I will tell you this. Nine times out of ten, my opinion is going to be more accurate than what you're reading on the internet. I'm just going to tell you that right now. That's just truth, right? And this is the problem with the internet. The internet gives us access to information, right? But if you don't have the foundation to understand what it is that you're reading, like if you don't have the background, then it's hard to interpret and really understand what it is that it is that you're reading. Like, and I'll use the example, you know, we have, you know, Bob, Mike, these are finance guys right here, right? I can read stuff on the internet about finance. That doesn't mean that I truly understand it. And that doesn't mean that I'm going to be good at picking stocks simply because I read an article, right? And this is something that's really important, which is that the more education you have in an area, the more you realize what you don't know. So, because I might have a very deep understanding of religion. Adam has a very deep understanding of music. But that because I understand I have this deep understanding of that, what it means is I understand that I know very little about these other things. And so when it comes to something that I don't know something about, I turn to experts. I turn to people who have studied these things their entire lives. I'll give you an example. She's not here right now. She'll be at the next service because we have our meeting. But Laura Carlson. So she's our clerk of session. She has a PhD in constitutional law. Now, I can get online, and I can read the Constitution, and I can read articles about the Constitution. But comparing the two of us, her knowledge of the Constitution, I'm like a preschooler compared to her, right? Now, some of you, you might have more background in it. You might be like elementary or middle or high school. If you're a lawyer, you might have, right, a college-level foundation. But what you have to realize is somebody like her, there's only about a handful of people like her in the country. So if we're in a circle and we're having a conversation about the Constitution and Laura's there, and somebody says, Alex, what do you think about the Constitution? I would say, it doesn't matter what I think. Why don't we talk to Laura? Because she spent her entire life talking about it. I'm not an expert. She is. And I want to hear her opinion about it. Right? And this brings us really to the crux of the matter, which is that this term expert in our world, it doesn't matter to people anymore because everybody's an expert, right? Just get on Google, I'll put my expert hat on for you, right? And I think this is why we're in so much trouble. This is our come to Jesus moment for today, guys. I think a big reason why our society is like a plane going down is because we don't acknowledge what it is that we don't know. We don't have the humility to sit there and say, I don't know about that. And I'm going to step back and let people who do know about it figure it out. It's just the way that we're operating. And to me, I think that the end game of this is really, really bad. Now, Jesus, what does he say? We read this line from Jesus, and Jesus says, you want to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, what do you need to do? You need to become humble like a child. Now, to an outsider, I remember when I first read that text. So this is me as an outsider. I hadn't studied religion, none of that. I read this text, and I thought, oh, I know what he's saying. He's saying he wants us to be compliant. He wants us to just accept whatever we're told. That was my outsider's reading of it. Now that I'm on the inside and I understand the text, I realize that I was way wrong about that, right? Because have you ever met a child? They ask why a million times. They ask questions about everything. Why? Because they are humble enough to understand they don't know everything about the world. And so they look to adults to inform them. They know you have more life experience. They know you have more knowledge. And that's why a child will say, tell me, help me to know. That's what it means to be humble like a child. But what happens when we become adults? Well, when we become an adult, right, We've learned all of this information and we've formed our perspective. And it can become very hard at that point for us to want to learn new information because that new information can undermine our perspective. I'll give you an example of this, something that happened here. So I came here 9 years ago. Do you remember how old I was?
Younger.
12. Yeah, that's right, younger. You're like, I know some of you were like, he was very young. I was 33 when I came here, right? Now, I had all these years of study, all these years of experience. I was bringing expertise, and I was so excited because I had been in churches my whole life, and there was all this information that I wanted you all to know that nobody had ever told you about before. And I thought, they're going to love it. What could go wrong, right? So I come in, and I start preaching about all this stuff. And what I notice is that people are becoming very uncomfortable because I'm starting to shake the foundations of what you believe. And it takes, I mean, let's be honest, it takes humility. I'm 33 at the time. I'm less than half the age of most of the people in this congregation. It takes a certain level of humility to look at a guy like me and to say, okay, I'm willing to listen to what you have to say. And to your credit, many of you did that. You were willing to say, I'm not buying everything you're saying hook, line, and sinker, but I'm willing to listen to you. And that privilege that you gave to me is something that we just need to apply to the rest of our lives. We simply need to be willing to acknowledge what we don't know and look to the experts who are in those fields. Susan Burton, right? She is an expert in incarceration. Now, you're welcome to have your opinion about, you know, criminal justice system and all that, right? But if I'm in a circle again and we're talking about incarceration, I'm going to shut up and I'm going to listen to what she has to say because she knows that better than anybody. She not only was in the system, she works with people who are outside of it. So again, we need to give them their due. And so when we're talking about these two guys, the story that I told you today about Barney Graham and Jason McClellan, these two guys, they not only changed our world, but they saved our lives. And we need to respect that expertise. And I want to end by telling you about the day that Barney Graham heard the results of the vaccine trials. So you may remember in 2020 that we were waiting all that year to hear, was it going to work? How effective was it going to be, right? And so he had given his scheme to both Moderna and Pfizer. They used different delivery mechanisms, but it's the same scheme. And Pfizer finished their trials first. And so he gets a call from the president of Pfizer, and he says, Barney, I want you to know that your vaccine was breathtakingly effective, far better than what we ever could have expected or hoped for. And he walks in to see his wife. She's in the kitchen. And he can barely get the words out to tell her that it worked. He couldn't barely tell her this because he'd had the weight of this on his shoulders for the last 10 months. He had made a lot of decisions about this vaccine that would impact billions of people around the world. And he just started sobbing. And he walked into his study, he sat down, his family crowded around him. He hadn't cried that hard since his father died. And I want you to know something about this guy. That scheme was his. It's his patent. He could have made billions of dollars off of this if he wanted to. But you know what he did? He handed it over to the federal government, and he said, this is for the benefit of society. It's for you and for me. And for that, we should be grateful. Amen.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to learn more about First Presbyterian Church of Arlington Heights, please visit www.firstpresah.org for more information on service times, directions, and to learn more about the First Pres family of faith.